Last time we simply read the question or the condition of Arjuna. I would like you to open page number 532. You have got the book Essays on the Gita. 532. I don't know if it is the same page in your book. If you can give me, I will find out.
Yes, 2 pages more.
2 pages more, yes? In these 5-6 lines, Sri Aurobindo has analyzed the state of Arjuna when he refuses to fight. So I would like to study these 5-6 lines first. The refusal of Arjuna to persevere in his divinely appointed work proceeded from the ego sense in him, ahamkara. Behind it was a mixture and confusion and tangled error of ideas and impulsions of the sattvic, rajasic, tamasic ego. The vital nature's fear of sin and its personal consequences. The heart's recoil from individual grief and suffering. The clouded reason's covering of egoistic impulses by self-deceptive, specialized ease of right and virtue. Our nature's ignorant shrinking from the ways of God because they seem other than the ways of man and impose things terrible and unpleasant on his nervous and emotional parts and his intelligence. These lines describe accurately the entire cry of Arjuna and his decision that he is not going to fight. He does not in the first place even ask what he should do. He decides, I shall not fight. So that's why Sri Aurobindo speaks of the refusal of Arjuna. And although the words may seem the words of wisdom, the words of great renunciation, Nakankshe Rajyam, he says, I don't want the kingdom. I don't want all bhogas, all the enjoyment. So it looks as if it's a tremendous renunciation on his part. But, as Sri Aurobindo points out, it proceeds from the ego sense in him, ahamkara. In fact, that is the reason why Sri Krishna, when he starts speaking to Arjuna, he rebukes him. He doesn't encourage him saying, no, Narakamsha Rajyam is a wonderful statement. He doesn't say wonderful, you do not want this, you do not want that. On the contrary, he says, what is this weakness that has gripped you? What is this recoil? It is because it proceeded from the ego sense. Now the words that Sri Aurobindo has written here are in a sense, you might say, merciless analysis of Arjuna's state of mind. In fact, the importance of these words lies in the fact that all of us are cast in the type of Arjuna. Arjuna was a preeminent man, the highest human being in his own type of his own times. And when he was confronted with a terrible action, and which, as Sri Aurobindo says, which was divinely appointed, an action that was not an ordinary action, but it was divinely appointed action. And now you see how many strengths in his special statements that he makes. Behind it was a mixture and confusion and tangled error of ideas and impulsions. So, there was confusion, error of ideas, error of impulsions. And these also were mixed sattvic, rajasic, tamasic, and all shot through an egoistic sense. Then there was the vital nature's fear of sin and its personal consequences. When he says that when we do sins of this kind, then we have to go to hell and to a great suffering. That was his argument. So vital nature's fear of sin, the heart's recoil from individual grief and suffering. Again, individual, his own grief and suffering. When he says, what is there when I have to enjoy after killing those very people with whom I would like to enjoy the fruits of my endeavor and my victory? So it is again his personal enjoyment that he would have liked very much to share his victory with his friends in his own way. The clouded reasons covering of egoistic impulses. This is one of the most merciless sword of Sri Aurobindo. The clouded reasons covering, he covers as it were, these egoistic impulses, although what he says is egoistic, he gives a covering to it as if it shows that he is very wide and very virtuous and he is speaking from the highest point of view of the virtue of the whole race. So, reasons covering of egoistic impulses by self-deceptive, even he deceives himself, specious pleas are the pleas or arguments which seem in appearance to be right, but in themselves they are wrong. Specious pleas of right and virtue. And then the last sentence, our nature's ignorant shrinking from the ways of God. We have normally only one vision of God as merciful, benevolent, full of love. But we do not know that God has many faces, many aspects. He is not only love, but he is eternal peace. And sometimes when you are in need of love and you approach the peaceful God, you feel that he is hard like a rock. Because it is nothing but peace. You don't get from him any kind of, that kind of emotional response that you expect from him. He is also the one who has sword in his hands. He has discus in his hands. The weapons of various kinds. And sometimes he demands with a wrathful face. He is not only peace, not only love. He is also the wrath of Rudra. And the terrible. It is like the loving mother who, when the invader comes to hurt her child, then it is not the loving mother, not the peaceful mother, it is the wrathful mother who wants to destroy the invader. That also is the face of the Lord. And when that face is before us, our ignorant self is troubled, not understanding that wrath, not understanding the tremendous love that is behind it, who wants to protect everybody and wants to destroy the invader. But we do not want to see that face. And that is why nature's ignorant shrinking from the ways of God, because they seem other than the ways of man, and impose things terrible and unpleasant on his nervous and emotional parts and his intelligence. In fact, this is the face of God that Arjuna was facing, the wrathful God who is beyond, before him. And there was a tremendous demand to do something that normal human beings would never demand. To kill one's own grandfather whom one has worshipped all his life, and his friends and his gurus and his colleagues. And when you stand before them, normally human beings would never impose such things upon anybody. But not knowing that God has this face also, and God at a certain stage of development in the world, he confronts you with a terrible task, and your nature normally shrinks from it. It is that shrinking which is to be defended by Arjuna, and therefore there is a covering of his shrinking to show that I am not really shrinking. I would like to do the best. I would like to do that which is virtuous. And that is the argument that comes up automatically. The real renunciation is something quite different. There is the vital impulse to embrace that which is attractive. It is the same vital which recoils from that which is attractive. They are only the two faces of the same vital. The one towards which you are attracted at a certain stage, and that which you embrace, at a certain stage you find that this is a terrible embrace, and then you return and you say, I don't want to do anything with that object which was attracting me so much. And you may, in doing so, use the language of morality and virtue, saying, I do not care, I do not wish, I have no desire. Actually, it is simply a recoil of the same vital. Instead of attraction, it is repulsion. It is not renunciation, it is only repulsion. You are repelled. So Arjuna, when he says, Nakanksha Rajyam, I do not wish the kingdom, it is not the words of renunciation, it is the recoil, it is the loss of faith in the object of attraction. These very things Sri Aurobindo analyzes earlier. Vitally, the loss of attraction and faith in the recognized and familiar objects of action and aims of life. Emotionally, the recoil of the ordinary feelings of social man, affection, reverence, desire of a common happiness and satisfaction, from a stern duty outraging them all. Morally, the elementary sense of sin and hell and rejection of blood-stained enjoyments. Practically, this sense that the standards of action have led to a result which destroys the practical aims of action. But the whole upshot is that all-embracing inner bankruptcy, which Arjuna expresses when he says that his whole conscious being, not the thought alone, but heart and vital desires and all, are utterly bewildered and can find nowhere the dharma, nowhere any varied law of action. This is the analysis of the situation. Now, that being very important, I would like to go once again through the argument of Arjuna in the original, in the Bhagavad Gita. You have got it, no?
Nasam deva siddhanti mam.
Yes, siddhanti mam adatrani. You have got it, I have got only one copy with me.
No, because last time only given I have my understanding.
It doesn't matter. In the original, Sivanti mama datrani, the limbs of my body get shrunk. Sivanti mama datrani, mukham cha parishushyate, my mouth gets dried up. Vepathushcha sharire, my whole body is full of shudderings. Roma harshascha jayate, and my hairs stand on end. This is all sensational revolt. This is the discussion of the sensations. Tiranti mama datrani mukham cha parishushyate, vepathushcha sharire me roma harshascha jayate. Gandivam sansate, my bow, Gandiva, slips down, hastat, from my hands. Tvakcha eva paridahyate, and my skin is on fire. Nacha shaknomi avasthatum, I am not even able to stand. Brahmati ivacha me manaha, and my mind seems as if wandering. Nuvittani cha pashyami viparitani keshava. And I see all around viparitani, adverse, nuvittani, omens. O Keshava. Nacha shreyaha anupashyami. I don't see anything good. Nacha shreya anupashyami. Hatva svajanam ahave. In this battle, ahave, in the battle, having killed svajanam. Now, from sensation, he moves towards a vital condition. Hatva svajanam, but it is egoistic, svajanam. It is my own people, having killed my own people in this battle, I see nothing good. Now this vital recoil, up till now was sensational revolt. Now comes the vital revolt. Nakankshe vijayam, there is a vital recoil. Instead of attraction, there is now repulsion. Nakankshe vijayam Krishna, nacha rajyam sukhani cha, nor do I wish the kingdom, nor the happiness. Kim no rajye na govinda, kim bhogehi jivite nava. What is the use of the kingdom? What is the use of enjoyments? What is the use of living? This is all vital reaction. It is not the renunciation of a yogi. It is a pure reversion because it is preceded by svajanam ahave hatva. It is my people whom I want to about to kill, and therefore I am shrinking from there.
Yesham arthe kankshitam no rajyam bhogaha sukhanicha. For whose sake? Yesham arthe kankshitam. For whose sake we desire our kingdom, no rajyam, bhogaha sukhanicha, and enjoyments and happiness. Te ime avasthita yuddhe pranan tyaktva dhananicha. It is these very people who are standing before me. You can see the attachment to these people, personal egoistic attachment. De ime avasthita yuddhe pranan tyaktva. They have already given up their lives. See how better they are than myself. They are already there, given up, having given up their own lives. Dhananicha, their all wealth they have given up, their lives they have given up, and they are standing, it is for whose benefit or for whose enjoyment I would like to do anything in life. You see the scope of the life and scope of the motive of life. What do I live for? For Swajana. For my people I live. That entire idea of the duty, of the righteousness, of the people being oppressed by the evil forces, all this has disappeared. It's not in the field. Yesham arthe kankshitam no rajyam bhogaha sukhanicha, te ime avasthita yuddhe pranans tyaktva dhananicha. Acharyaha, pitaraha, putraha, tateva cha pitamaha. Who are these people? They are teachers, acharyaha, pitaraha, fathers, putraha, sons, and also pitamaha, the grandsires, the grandfathers, matulaha, shashuraha, those who are, in whose relationship I am a son-in-law. Matulaha, shashuraha, pautraha, even my grandsons, shyalaha, my brothers-in-law, sambandhinastatha, all kinds of relatives. Etan, nahantum ichhami, I don't wish to kill them. Now you can see that from vital, there is a further development of what is called emotional revolt. There is a vital recoil from sukham and from rajyam, and then comes the emotional attachments to all the people whom he describes and says, how can I suffer this suffering of my people, emotional attachment with whom I are so great? Etanna hantum ichhami gnatopi Madhusudana. Even if I am killed, gnatopi, even if I am killed, O Madhusudana, I don't wish to kill them. Api trailokya rajyasya hetoho. I do not wish to kill them, even though I may be killed, for the sake of the kingdom of three realms. Trailokya rajyam, that is earth, heaven and the supreme. Whatever is the highest and everything combined together, even for that sake I am not prepared to kill them. Kimna mahi krute. Then what is this, only for the sake of the earth? Even three kingdoms, if I could be given by killing them, I won't do it. What is the question of having only this earth in return to this victory? Nihatya dhartrashtran naha kapritihi syatyanardana. By killing the sons of Dhritarashtra, what will be the happiness in it? Kapritihi. Dapam eva. Now comes the moral sense, the moral revolt. It is gradually, you can see how beautifully Vyasa has described the condition, sensational, vital, emotional, and now moral. Papam eva ashrayet. I will only resort to sin. Asmat, asman, hatva, etan atatayinaha. These are all ready to fight. But having killed them, I'll only enter into sin. So this is a new argument. Up till now it was only emotional, my brothers, my friends. Now comes a greater argument that this will be a sin. That is to say, even from a universal point of view, not only because they are my brothers and my fathers and grandfathers, but now the sin is a concept which is a more universal concept. When you do a wrong thing in itself, from a universal point of view, then it is sin. So now he brings another argument, which is a moral crisis. Papam eva ashretasman hatva etan atatayinaha. Tasmat, therefore, na arha, we don't deserve, vayam hantum, we don't deserve to kill them, dhatrashtran swabandhavan. Swabandhavan, again, there is a lapse again to the emotional crisis. As Sri Aurobindo says, there's a confusion tangle of error, which is egoistic, shot through egoism of sattva, rajas and tamas altogether. Svajanam hi katham hatva sukhinha syama madhava. Having killed svajanam, having killed our own people, O Madhava, syama, how shall we be sukhinaha? How shall we become happy? So once again, there is an emphasis on svajanam. Now comes the virtue. Again, it's a moral crisis. And imagine the vastness of his proposition. Yadi api ete na pashyanti lobha upahata chetasaha. Even if they don't see, yadi api ete na pashyanti, even if they don't see what is right and wrong, why? Because lobha upahata chetasaha. Because their consciousness is killed by lobha, by greed. Kurakshaya kritam dosham mitradrohe chapatakam. But what do they not see? Kurakshaya kritam dosham. The error which arises by the kurakshaya, by the destruction of the entire family, clan. Mitradrohe, by treachery of the friend. Patakam, the sin. They don't see the sin. But katham nagneyam asmavi. But I am not like that who are ignorant. I am jayam. I am one who knows. Katham nagneyam asmavihi. Papat asman nivartitum. But having known ourselves that this is a sin, they may not see because they are lobha upahata chetasa. They are shrouded. They are clouded by the greed. But having known ourselves, why should we not be free, nivartitum? Why should you not come back from papa, from the sin? Gurakshaya kritam dosham prapashyat, because we can see very well the dosha, the error that arises by the destruction of the clan. Janardana. This is the specious argument. They are narrow, but I am so wide. I understand. They don't understand, therefore they are not to be blamed. Because they don't know, their consciousness is blinded, but my consciousness is not blinded. I see very clearly that this is kulakshayam dosham. Kulakshaye pranashyanti. Now he expounds the whole theory. Why kulakshayam dosham? Why is it papa? Why is it sin? Now he expounds, why is it a sin? Kulakshaye pranashyanti kuladharmaha sanatana. If the whole clan is destroyed, then kuladharmaha pranashyanti. Then the laws, the dharma of the family are all destroyed. Kuladharmas which are sanatana, the eternal laws of the family, of the clan, are destroyed. Dharme nashte, and when dharma is destroyed, kulam krishnam, the whole family, adharma abhibhavati uta, the whole family becomes seized by adharma, abhibhavati. adharma takes possession of the entire family. And then he explains to Sri Krishna what happens thereafter. If adharma takes place, then he says to Sri Krishna, adharma abhimavat Krishna pradushyanti kulastriyaha. O Krishna, when adharma seizes the whole clan, then kulastriyaha pradushyanti. Then the women of the clan enter into a sin. Strishu dushtasu vashneya jayate varnasankaraha. When the women fall into sin, then the offspring will be bastard offspring, varnasankaraha. Now he further explains the exposition of morality, the exposition of dharma, and his own awareness, whereas they are all blinded, but he is very fully aware of what happens if you fall into this kind of a papa. Sankaraha narakaya eva kulagnanam kulasyacha. And when this kind of bastard offspring arises, this kind of mixture arises, Sankaraha actually is a mixture. Sankaraha narakaya eva. It leads you straight to hell. For whom kulagnanam, when you destroy your own kula, kulasya cha, even the whole family is destroyed. It is the only end is going to hell. And when you go to hell, further thing happens. Patante pitara. Even the forefathers who have died, even they do not receive the water and offering from you, which sustains them in the higher good condition, even after death. Patante pitarah yesham lupta pinda udaka kriyaha. Pinda, what food you offer and what water you offer. That offering who will do when you go to hell? So even that will not happen. Therefore, even your forefathers, they will suffer. Patante pitarah yesham lupta pinda udaka kriyaha. Doshaihi etaihi kulagnanam varnasankara karakaihi utsadyante jati dharmaha kuladharmaha cha shashvata. That is why all these sins, all these errors take place because of the killing of your clan, and because of that bastard offering arises, and therefore all the jati dharmaha, all the dharmas of the clan, and all this kula dharmaha, all the laws which are binding the family and which are eternal, they all are transgressed. Utsadyante, they are all transgressed. Utsanna kula dharmanam manushyanam janardana narake aniyatam vasaha bhavati iti anushushruma. He has been a very learned man. So he says, iti anushushruma. We have already heard what happens. Narake aniyatam vasaha. We have got to stay eternally into the hell. When? Utsanna kula dharmanam manushyanam. When you destroy the dharmas of people and of the clan, then the only result is that you have to live in a hell for eternity. Aho, bata, mahatpapam kartum vyavasita vayam. Alas, indeed, mahatpapam kartum, a great sin is about to be committed. Vyavasita vayam, we are engaged in committing a great sin. Yad rajya sukalobhena hantum svajanam udyataha. And all this for what? Rajya sukalobhena, only for the greed of happiness and of kingdom. For that we have become ready to kill our own people. Now comes his last renunciation and a great sacrifice. And he says, Yadi mam apratikaram ashastram shastrapanayah dhatrashtra rane hanyuhu tatme kshemataram bhavet. Yadi if mam apratikaram, apratikaram means one who does not resist, ashastram, unarmed, I would like to be unresisting, I would like to be without any arms in my hands. Yadi mam apratikaram ashastram shastrapranaya. These Dhritarashtra, these sons of Dhritarashtra, they all have got arms. Shastra pani. Pani means the hands. Shastra means the weapons. They have got arms in their hands. Dhritarashtra rane hanyu. They armed with weapons. I unarmed and unresisting. If they kill me, hanyu, tat make shemadaram bhavet. That will become much better for me. I unarmed, unresisting, and they armed in their hands. And if they kill me in the battlefield, that is kshemataram bhavet, it will become much better. Evam muktva arjuna sankhe rathopasthe upavishat visritya sasharam chapam shoka samvigna manasaha. Evam muktva, having said this, Arjun, sankhe, in the battle, rathopasthe, in the seat of his chariot, upavishat, he sat down. He gave up visritya sasharam chapam, his bow, which was already strung with the arrow, sasharam chapam, that arrow, that bow, visrijya, he gave up. Shoka samvigna manasaha. And his whole mind was completely bewildered with grief, shoka. This is the description of Vyasa. And you can see how psychologically Vyasa himself analyzes Arjuna. The sensational, the vital, emotional, moral, practical. In all the levels of his consciousness, one by one, every part of his being. Now, it is this argument, this kind of question in which there is so much of confusion and there is so much of sattva. It's not only rajas and tamas, it is so much of sattva. And so much a sense of self-giving, so much of sense of sin in the action, so much of awakening when he says, I know what is right. Anushushrama, I know also what others, seers have said, what happens. So with this much of knowledge, with this much of moral sense awakened against the sin, all this mixed together, but everything shot with swajanam, everything which is shot for swasukam, swarajyam, the whole scope is egoism. It is in that scope that everything is confined in the whole argument. Now imagine from here, the real solution of the problem is so far. If it was a very near answer, it would have been very easy to answer within a short time. But the answer that has to be given, so wide. And that is also the importance of the questioning. If the questions were very easy, they could have been answered easily. But no, the questions are extremely difficult. They are challenging questions. And ordinary answers will not do. Why? Because the answer that will come will be only at the highest level of consciousness. The consciousness which is limited in the egoistic consciousness, which is so much shaken vitally and sensationally. and which has confused ideas of right and wrong, and which even is prepared to make a tremendous sacrifice of one's own life and one's own life mission. To that consciousness, the answer that has to be given has to be at the deepest level. As Sri Aurobindo says, an ordinary question could not have produced the Bhagavad Gita. The question must have been extremely serious, extremely challenging, and something that happens so typically to human beings at the most crucial moment of life. That is why we turn to the Gita so often, and again and forever. Now imagine the answer that Sri Krishna has to build up. Let us go immediately to the full answer that Sri Krishna wants to give to him. Then we can see the distance between this and the real answer. Again, if you open that chapter, The Supreme Secret, Sri Aurobindo summarizes the entire answer of the whole Bhagavad Gita in a few lines. This is chapter number 22, The Supreme Secret, the very first paragraph. Having given the full answer over the 18 chapters, now Sri Aurobindo summarizes that answer in a few lines. He says, the essence of the teaching and the yoga has thus been given to the disciple on the field of his work and battle, and the divine teacher now proceeds to apply it to his action, but in a way that makes it applicable to all action. Not only to Arjuna's action, but everybody's action. Now this is the summary. Attest to a crucial example spoken to the protagonist of Kurukshetra, the words bear a much wider significance and are a universal rule for all who are ready to ascend above the ordinary mentality and to live and act in the highest spiritual consciousness. What is the teaching? This is the answer. To break out of ego and personal minds and see everything in the wideness of the self and spirit. To know God and adore Him in His integral truth and in all His aspects. To surrender all oneself to the transcendent soul of nature and existence. To possess and be possessed by the divine consciousness. To be one with the one in universality of love and delight and will and knowledge. One in Him with all beings. To do works as an adoration and a sacrifice on the divine foundation of a world in which all is God, and in the divine status of a liberated spirit is the sense of the Gita's yoga. The entire experience and the status to which the soul has to ascend is given here in all these 5-6 steps. I should like to read again because they deserve repetition again and again. They are the quintessence of the whole teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. I don't think anywhere in the whole world such a summary of the whole teaching of the Gita is given in one sentence. Have you got it? Chapter number 22, The Supreme Secret. Have you got it? To break out of ego and personal mind and see everything in the wideness of the self and spirit. To know God and adore him in his integral truth and in all his aspects, to surrender all oneself to the transcendent soul of nature and existence, to possess and be possessed by the divine consciousness, to be one with the one in universality of love and delight and will and knowledge, one in him with all beings, to do works as an adoration and a sacrifice on the divine foundation of a world in which all is God, and the divine status of a liberated spirit is the sense of the Gita's yoga. I should like to dwell a little more on this question of Arjuna, because unless we understand the question, we cannot understand the answer. That is why we are taking so much time on the questioning of Arjuna. I have summarized in a schematic form this question of Arjuna. This is the analysis of the whole situation. When Arjuna entered the battlefield, his mind was clear and convinced that the claim of the Pandavas to their legal rights was perfectly justified, and that his own duty as a warrior and as a soldier was to protect the right, to fight for the rights, and to establish the rights, even if that meant a battle and a war with those who were protagonists of the illegal and unjust claims. But as he began to view the armies on the battlefield, his mind became filled with sensations and emotions, with thoughts and arguments, with deliverances of conscience at various levels, sattvic, rajasic, tamasic. He felt a disabling disgust towards material objects, towards action, towards life itself. It is this disgust that Arjuna expressed in short but piercing statements. In the first place, he said that he would like to reject that aim of life which seeks enjoyment and happiness. In other words, he rejected what you might call in modern terms the aim of egoistic hedonism. Egoistic hedonism is a theory which says that you should seek your own pleasure. So he first of all says, I renounce. Egoistic hedonism is a very low thing, to seek one's own pleasure, enjoyment. Oh no, this I don't want. Secondly, he declared that he would reject the aim which seeks to attain victory and rule and power and government of man. In other words, he rejected what may be called the vital aim of enjoyment that was allowed in the Indian ethos to the Kshatriya. This was the one enjoyment that you fight the unjust, destroy, establish, and then enjoy the kingdom. This enjoyment was allowed to the Kshatriya in the Indian ethos. But he says, even that is a lower aim, and I do not want that aim. Thirdly, he rejected the ethical element. That was the mainspring of the entire preparation of the war. Now, this ethical element is a very important element of the whole argument. So, I am analyzing it in detail. His argument could be translated as follows. What exactly is justice involved in fighting the war that was just to commence? The ethical element was that he was fighting for justice. So now he asks the question, what is justice? What exactly is justice involved in fighting the war that was just to commence? Is it not, he asked, interest of himself, his brothers, and of his party for possession, enjoyment and rule? What was the injustice in the situation? We are not allowed to rule. And we means that is the only justice, that we should be allowed to rule. Is that the meaning of justice? I don't want that kind of justice. It is only a selfish kind of a proposition. So he says, what is this justice involved in fighting the war that was just to commence? Is it not, he asked, interest of himself, his brothers, and of his party for possession, enjoyment and rule? And even if it be granted that these aims were justified, he raised by implication the question as to what would be the cost of securing their justice. Would it not mean, he asked, the sacrifice of the right maintenance of social and national life, which in the person of the kin of the race stood before him, opposing him in the battlefield? This is the subtlety of the question. Even if it is allowed by Kshatriya Dharma to kill the unjust, and even the enjoyment is allowed by the Dharma, then he says, what is the price you have to pay for this kind of upholding of Dharma? The price you have to pay is the sacrifice of the right maintenance of social and national life. If it was a small thing to be decided, it's all right. But here, I am going to destroy social and national life, which is represented by my opponents today, because they are also part of the national life. This is one line of his argument, where his ethical element for which he had come, the main sustaining force was the ethical element. Very often it is said that Arjuna was so clouded, he forgot his dharma. Which is not true. If you analyze the argument, it is not that he has forgotten what is dharma. He had come for dharma, to establish justice and right, but now new questions have arisen. If that justice can be established only by paying a price which is so heavy that even the national life is destroyed, then where is the question of that justice? Now he turns to another argument. Turning to another line of argument, Arjuna seems to feel that even if happiness and life are desirable, they are desirable only if they are shared with all others, particularly with our own people. In modern terminology, Arjuna was referring to the doctrine that seeks to secure maximum happiness for the maximum number of people. Even if I destroy these people, the happiness will be only ours. But the higher ethical doctrine is that you should have the maximum number of people sharing the maximum number of amount of happiness, which is a higher principle. But here Arjuna argued by implication, our own people are to be slain. And who would consent to slay them for the sake of all the earth, or even for the kingdom of three worlds? At this stage, Arjuna formulates even more fundamental objection. This argument becomes even more formidable. He declares that slaughter is a sin. And mutual slaughter is a heinous crime. in which there is no right and no justice. And this is a heinous sin. When those who are to be slain are objects of love and reverence. So, the argument that Arjuna puts forward is very formidable. The whole idea of justice is now overshadowed by all these considerations. What price you want to have justice? Formulating this ethical argument further, he grants that the sons of Dhritarashtra are guilty of grave offenses, of sins of greed and selfish passion. But Arjuna argues that they are overpowered by ignorance and they have no sense of guilt. But would it be right, he asks in effect, to enter into a sinful act voluntarily with a clear knowledge that sin is to be committed? Once again, he brings in another ethical consideration. Even if a sin is to be committed, and even if that could be justified in one way or the other, how could it be justified if that leads to the destruction of family morality, social law, law of the nation? Arjuna declares that a family itself will be brought to the point of annihilation. Morals will be corrupted. The race will be sullied. Laws of race, morality, and family will be destroyed. And who will be the author of these crimes?
Well, the conflict is only between adharma and dharma. And that was the conflict which he had already resolved when Arjuna entered in the battlefield. He knew that the fight is between adharma and dharma. And the I stand for dharma and they stand for adharma. But when dharma collides with dharma, and that is the real conflict, the problem became unresolvable because dharma, to establish justice, was collided with the price that had to be paid, which would create a dharma. While doing dharma, if you are going to produce another adharma, if the offspring becomes varna sankara, when all the dharmas of the family and the clan are to be destroyed, then how are you to reconcile if by doing dharma you are going to produce adharma? How are you to resolve the problem? If you don't fight, then adharma already reigns. Therefore, you must fight. But if by fighting you are going to produce adharma, then should you fight? This is the dilemma. This is a great question. It raises the basic question, what is dharma, what is adharma? Are our notions of dharma and adharma exactly correct, accurate? This raises the question of the entire ethics. Ethics actually is a study of decision of what is right and what is wrong. And if you study the entire history of ethics, if you want to summarize the entire history of ethics, you will find that ethical philosophy has given no unanimous answer as to what is right and what is wrong. Normally in a science, you have one unanimous answer, that this is the disease and this is the answer to cure it. But in the field of what is right and what is wrong, even after so many thousands of years, people have discussed this question, what is right and what is wrong, this has not been answered unanimously. And that is why there is a big question. If you study even the modern ethics developed by Europe, it's passed through three stages of the ethical thought. There is a doctrine that the highest good is pleasure. This is one view. Highest good is pleasure. And you must pursue pleasure because that is highest good. This is called the doctrine of egoistic hedonism. To seek one's own pleasure and to maximize this pleasure and to have the longest duration of pleasure, that is the doctrine of ethical egoistic hedonism. It's ethical, it's a doctrine of ethics. There's a difference between psychological hedonism and ethical hedonism. Psychological hedonism only says that no, all human beings pursue their own pleasure. This is psychological hedonism. There's a long debate in Europe. Is it a correct doctrine? But without going into this debate, the general proposition that is made is that it is a fact that every human being seeks his own pleasure, psychologically. And then the argument is that since everybody seeks one's own pleasure, that which is desired is desirable. This is the argument. That which is desired is desirable. Therefore, one ought to desire, that is, transition from psychological hedonism to ethical hedonism. From what one normally does, what you cannot prevent, what automatically happens, it is that which should be desired then. What is desired is desirable. Of course, there is a fallacy in the argument, but this is the argument which is put forward. What is eatable? That which you can eat. Isn't it? You can't eat a cassette. It's not eatable because it's not an object of eating. That which is eaten, that which can be eaten, is eatable. So what is desirable? That which can be desired and which is desired is desirable. So this is the first answer to what is right and what is wrong. Everybody normally seeks one's own pleasure. Since it is desired, it is desirable. Therefore, everybody ought to seek one's own pleasure. Then, second point is that since everybody seeks to maximize one's pleasure, therefore, one should maximize one's pleasure. And how to maximize it? The European ethical thinkers have even gone to the length of making a calculus. They propose that you should have a kind of a chart and make all your objects of desire into a kind of a scale. And then see from what object do you get the maximum pleasure. Because it is also accepted that this world is such that pleasure is always mixed with pain. And pain is something which you like to reject. And pleasure is what you like to embrace. Therefore, you should try to maximize by making a chart. There are so many objects of pleasure. Which one gives you the best pleasure, highest pleasure? So, by doing so, first of all, you have the quantity of pleasure. That which gives you the highest quantity of pleasure is the object of your seeking. Second is the duration of pleasure. You may have some great pleasure, quantity may be very great, but duration is short. Then in calculus, you should give less marks to it. You should have the greatest quantity of pleasure, and then you should have the longest duration. Third is the intensity of pleasure. It's not enough that you have duration is long. Some pleasures are long in duration, but the intensity is not so great. So you should have intensity. So quantity, intensity and duration, all the three, maximize that. And that you can do only by making a chart. It's not easy to find out which is that pleasure which gives you the longest pleasure, the most intense pleasure, most durable pleasure. This is the first answer of ethical, egoistic hedonism. It is ethical because it says you ought to. You ought to seek this pleasure, therefore it's ethical. And why is it ethical? Because you are desiring. What is desired is desirable. Therefore you should pursue this. This is a straight argument. I am only summarizing the argument given by one great thinker called Bentham. Bentham was a great philosopher of morality, ethical thinker. And this is his doctrine, which he gave in this. I am only summarizing. But this is the upshot of his whole argument. Now he had a pupil called Mill. And he was not satisfied with Bentham's doctrine. So he went one step forward. He granted that everybody seeks pleasure. Everybody seeks maximum amount of pleasure, greatest intensity of pleasure, longest duration of pleasure. But he argued that even your own pleasure is not so great when your pleasure is shared by others. Your own pleasure is one thing, but it has to be shared by others. And when it's shared by others, your own pleasure is increased. There are certain pleasures which are enjoyed by you alone. But that is not all. There are certain pleasures which are enjoyed better when they are shared with others, and their enjoyment increases your enjoyment. So in your calculus, there should be another column. Your own pleasure should be maximized in context of the greatest pleasure of others. So that is how the question of society came into the picture. This is not egoistic ethical hedonism, but which is called universal ethical hedonism. Not egoistic, but universal. You can see how Vyasa knew this doctrine earlier, where Arjuna himself says, what is this pleasure which is only for me? Those people for whose sake I would like to enjoy, and with whom I would like to share, if they are to be killed, what is my pleasure? So he is arguing ethical universal hedonism. And this is the argument which came in Europe much later in the 18th century. And Vyasa has declared this doctrine long, long ago. And Arjuna is aware of this doctrine, and therefore he could follow this doctrine. So as against purely egoistic ethical hedonism, he puts the argument of universal ethical hedonism. He says, what is this? I am only trying to seek my own pleasure. No. A greater pleasure is when I share it with others. In my calculus, the survival of my enemies is necessary, because only when I am victorious, I can enjoy with their company, then my pleasure is much greater. This is the doctrine in the West, as it is called, utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is a doctrine according to which you ought to seek the maximum pleasure of the maximum number of people. So when you want to do any action, you find out whether it's right or wrong by asking whether it will benefit the largest number of people and will give the largest amount of pleasure with the greatest intensity, with the longest duration. This is what is called hedonistic calculus. You make a calculus which is hedonistic. He even applied this to political action. If you want to pass a law, how will you decide whether that law is the right law? you find out what will be the effect of the passage of a law by the parliament. If that law is going to promote maximum pleasure of maximum number of people, then that law is right. If not, then you should not pass that law. Now there's a third doctrine in the West, which has been defined and which has been refined and formulated powerfully by a philosopher called Immanuel Kant. Now he examined the human nature once again. And he said, it is not true that human beings seek their own pleasure. He said, psychologically, it's not true. What is it that human beings seek, if not the pleasure? The answer was that human beings even seek pain. It's not true that everybody seeks pleasure only. People also seek pain. They do not come out of the path of pain simply because that path will lead you to pain. Why? Because there is a greater demand in human beings. And what is the demand? The demand to do the right action for the sake of being right. Even though it may produce unhappiness, with trouble, difficulties, austerity, human beings, according to him, have a motive to act only from the motive of doing the right action. And right action is not to be defined in terms of that which produces pleasure. Because people do right action even when pleasure is not obtained. Therefore it follows there is something other than pleasure. Rightness of action is something other than pleasure. In what then consists the rightness? If not in pleasure, in what consists the right action? His answer was, a right action is that which you can will at the same time to be universal. Personal pleasure you can never make universal. Even maximum pleasure you cannot make universal. That which you can make universal, that is the right action. An action which you can at the same time will to be universal. For example, I should tell a lie. Supposing this is the doctrine, I should tell a lie. He said, this is a proposition. If it was a real ethical law, then you should be able to make it universal. Now, try to make it universal. I should tell a lie. If everybody knows that he is going to tell a lie, is there a profit in telling a lie? If it is a law, universal law, everybody knows it is a universal law, then is there any profit in telling a lie? The lie is useful only so long as it wears the garb of truth. Then only it can succeed, otherwise it can't succeed. Therefore, tell a lie cannot become a universal law. So he said, you find out those principles which you can make universal. Tell the truth. Is applicable to all the whole world. Even if everybody knows that he is going to tell the truth, it will not destroy itself. So he argued that there is in the human being not a seeking of pleasure, but seeking the right itself, which is universal. He said the human being is so constituted psychologically, he cannot help to discover a law which is universal and an impulsion to do that and that alone and nothing else. This is his famous doctrine of duty for duty's sake. Why do you perform a duty? Duty is a universal law which you obey. And why do you do it? Because it is going to give you pleasure or pain or anything of the kind. Whether it gives pleasure or pain or anything, you do it because it is the right thing to do. It's the doctrine of duty for duty's sake. Now, even this idea is present in the mind of Arjuna. He had come with that idea that justice should be established. Justice by why? Because it is justice. Not because it is going to give me happiness or happiness to others or anything of the kind. Justice is justice. Whatever may happen. So that argument is known. Therefore, first of all, he says, egoistic hedonism is to be thrown away. Then he says, even the universal ethical hedonism is to be thrown away for the sake of justice, for the what is called the idea of categorical imperative. Kant's theory is called the theory of categorical imperative. An imperative is a command, do this. Categorical means unconditional. Not because you are going to get this result or that result. It's categorical. For its own sake. So he says again, he argues that yes, I know what is justice. And it is true I have come for justice. But now the more difficult question which arises, and that which takes Gita's teaching higher than that of Kant, that if that justice itself is going to produce injustice, if by doing this very just act I am going to kill all the people, and first of all, slaughter itself is a wrong thing, because if everybody slaughters everybody else, then where is the question of doing anything in the world at all? It's not a universal law. Universality lies only in things in which you can protect, maintain everybody. So slaughter itself is unethical, first of all. It's not a universal law. So slaughter itself is sin. So to establish justice, if I have to make slaughter, then that itself is adharma. So between these two, what have I to select? This dharma or that dharma? Kant was not aware that there are conflicts not only between adharma and dharma. There are conflicts even between dharma and dharma. And that is what makes Gita's teaching at a very high plane. When Arjuna says that this dharma I know, I would even fight in spite of all this. But when this slaughter itself is a sin, and further, that by doing this, a greater bastard progeny is going to be produced, in which dharma will not be resurrected at all, and there will be a reign of adharma. So doing itself, slaughter itself is a wrong action. It is going to produce a further wrong action because of the bastard progeny. In that condition, what is the solution? Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, when ever you think at the ethical level, all your standards of conduct, right and wrong, depend upon the stage at which you have reached in your development. If you are at the lowest level, then hedonism is all right. At a higher level, universal hedonism is all right. At a higher, still higher level, categorical imperative is all right. But when one categorical imperative fights against another categorical imperative, then the solution is only spiritual. You have to transcend ethicality. At the ethical level, there is no answer. The conflict of ethics can be resolved only at the spiritual level. And that is why Sri Krishna entered into a spiritual answer to the question. Alright, so now next time we shall study the fourth chapter, which is the core of the teaching.
Because the sort of pleasure is...
Prayer, correct, Shreya, correct.